You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is the 12th of January, 2022. As my life has entered a new phase, I need to do a little fundraising here. You guys have been extremely generous, whether it be in my Patreon page or directly through PayPal, and of course I want to thank Sven Longshanks for making a lot of that possible. He works very hard for very little. So not only do I need funds, but of course most certainly Sven and the channel does too. For those of you who don't know, Grandpa Dan is in stage four melanoma. And Orthodox people, and well, anyone, should do what they can to pray and to assist him in any way possible. Grandpa Dan is a good man and a friend of mine, extremely intelligent, and we can't lose this guy. So, whatever you can do for any of us is much appreciated. So, having no relationship to that, I want to talk about a topic. I think this is the second time this topic has come up. And it is that of postmodernism. Every once in a while, I get a request to talk about that. So I did Foucault, and today I'm going to do Jean Baudrillard, who died in 2007. If you pardon me, I have a little bit of a cold. And we've dealt with what postmodernism means. This is a huge issue for Alexander Dugin as well. And what it comes down to in the most basic brass tack sense is that there are no objects anymore. There are only words. That's what makes it postmodern. Yes, modernity was based on nominalism, but a word had to have some relation to the object. There has to be some referent. No, the referent is taken away, and there is nothing more than words. Now, of course, this comes straight from Nietzsche's concept, and of course the Kabbalistic idea of the flux. But there can't be any objective realities in the postmodern world. There can only be intersubjective ones. Objectivity and intersubjective are two very different things. An objective truth is one that is absolutely true in connection to a standard, Plato's forms, for example, the essence of a thing. Intersubjective simply means that a group of people agree that that's true, and over time it becomes just a part of their vocabulary. The closest you can get to truth in the postmodern sense is intersubjectivity, which in some senses serves nationalism quite well, but we can never base our worldview on it. Postmodernism is something, sometimes it depends on what mood you're in. It can be refreshing, it can be absolutely exhilarating, or it can be humorous and devastating. The concept of deconstruction is extremely important to postmodernists. The idea there is to take an idea, especially one that they don't like, and pick it apart. So all the corrupt means whereby it came about, how it became popular, how it became enforced, the make-believe and the fake words used to describe it, whatever. There's a million ways to deconstruct something. In other words, you know, Ten Commandments aren't really the Ten Commandments. This is all literary fiction, etc. They won't deal well, though, and they don't deal well when that's aimed at them. The criticism that the postmodern, like everything in academia, it's vaguely leftist, but it doesn't have to be. It's like existentialism in that sense. Deconstruction can be useful for us. You know, you talk about a practice, a law, a society, and you see where it came from, things that people don't know about, the falsity of it all, the violence that established it, the corrupt interests that promoted it. And if it's something that people kind of take for granted every day, it can be very striking. And they tried to do that even with Christopher Columbus. You turn that around on them, and it's a big problem. Part of the reason, of course, is that academics is purely intersubjective. Everyone agrees that some variation of the left is correct. You see, if you're a leftist in academia, which of course is redundant, you don't have to show that liberalism is true or some variation of liberalism is true. It's taken for granted. So you can have an article in a journal talking about, what can we do to keep the left in power or whatever. I mean, it's taken for granted. This is a legitimate academic argument in their minds. How can we keep Roe versus Wade legal? Or how can we maintain that? What could we do to maintain that, or at least the spirit of it? Not that Roe versus Wade is good or bad. That's not an issue. But activism relative to it. And it's simply taken for granted that it's a good thing, and they have to defend it. Those are just examples off the top of my head, but that's how this works. Therefore, and we'll talk about some authors related to Baudrillard here in a minute. It makes life in academia very difficult, especially for postmodernists. Baudrillard deconstructed liberalism once he did anything else, and he realized what he'd done. And you can't saw off the branch that you're sitting on, and so he simply left it vacuous. I have an entire book on Alistair MacIntyre, Romara Press, if you look for it. And it's almost a form of tokenism. Alistair MacIntyre argues for the tradition-bound nature of any real legitimate political discourse, that communities exist prior to individuals. It sounds great. Except that in his long career, he's never once given any content to what this community might be. As he's gotten more elderly, he'll eventually, he has stated that it's essentially liberal society, negative freedoms. But that's not a content. When you hear NATO talk about European values, now, they deny the existence of nations but have no problem with European values. It's always in the negative. It's, freedom of expression sometimes, religious toleration sometimes. But that's not the foundation of a society. Those are negatives. Culture, by definition, has positive things. The structure of the family, the structure of the church, basic beliefs, etc. Now, in academia, I don't believe social scientists should ever be reading Jean Baudrillard. And it's because primarily, and you see this in writers like Bogard, that he dissolves the social into nothing more than images. This has been a big part of my career long before I read Baudrillard. Things in social life, or even social life as such, is a series of images. He calls them simulacra. And again, images corresponding to no object. They're simply invented by those powerful enough to invent them and impose them onto people. And then those images, taken together, he calls the hyperreal. when the media promotes images which are, you know, made up or have no relation to anything, you know, they're meant to manipulate. These aren't real, they're hyper-real. So when it comes to public policy, you can't have any, you can't, it's impossible in such a world. And certainly nothing claiming to be a science could exist. Human rights can't possibly exist if this is all just a set of images. So while the postmodernists criticize, sometimes very well, as we'll see here, criticize the Western, or i.e. liberal social system and its economic market, they don't have anything positive to advocate. Since anything constructive must also be tainted by its interaction with the hyperreal. And this is an essential idea. MacIntyre is your token Aristotelian, but when he's pressed, doesn't believe anything that Aristotle believed. The problem with these guys in academia, they may take liberalism apart, and both of those men do that, but what are they going to say? What are they going to replace it with? And people like MacIntyre will talk about the importance of tradition in a society, but never pointing to a specific society. You see, when I did political philosophy in grad school and a bit afterwards, these are basically abstractions. You have to take these ideas and bring them into a actually existing or historical civilization. That's where Russia came in. It's the connection between political theory and comparative politics. But these guys will deconstruct liberalism and put nothing in its place. Because anything they may put in its place, not only, you know, will be false because it comes from the hyperreal, but it will expose them. So, for example, if Alistair MacIntyre were to say that an example would be classical Athens, he would be attacked because he would say, well, there was a slave society, women had minor rights, it was an aristocracy, whatever. And his career would be in a lot of trouble. That's why he has simply left it abstract. So if you believe this, and in our age, there's a lot of reasons to believe it, this critique of images renders our language of social life and politics false. Now, they can't say that, of course, because they're postmodernists. Nothing really is true. Again, in a different way, he saws off the intellectual branch that he's sitting on. But keep in mind that if social life is images and largely unreal or hyperreal, it also means that the language of rebellion is equally illusory. Now, Bogard is one of these liberal writers, talking about his 1990 book here, considers, you know, Baudrillard intolerable for these very reasons. And he says, Baudrillard radically denies the possibility of sociology by way of an argument which claims that the social field, i.e. the web of social relationships conceived as the empirical ground and reality principle for a uniquely sociological enterprise, is in the process of collapsing into an undifferentiated and homogeneous mass, a mass which is itself the product of a social process, yet can no longer be identified with any particular social subject or object. And of course, I explained briefly how that could be. What we see in media, talking heads, the pundits, columns, articles, these are simulacra. These are non-existent. Intersubjectively, they're true with the ruling class, but they're not true in general. They don't necessarily have to be invented or made up, but they certainly are put together in such a way that is to manipulate and even hypnotize the population. Now, Bogard, he writes this. He's incorrect when he says that society is in the process of collapsing into a mass of unreal images without reference. It's already done so. And sociology came from it. But his basic criticism is true. The criticism of Baudrillard's doctrine of images is correct. What I want to say here is that if social life is based on images, and images refer only to themselves, then those who project the images are insulated from all serious criticism. And it's because there's nowhere solid to stand. Language and politics and the social do not exist except as mental images that skillfully manipulate the herd. Yet the nature of this criticism doesn't yield any results. That's the problem. We could say the same about Karl Marx. Karl Marx went on and on. I read almost everything he's written. And there is nothing positive. He can criticize capitalism in many ways very well. But there is no concept of a new society. And a lot of that, in my mind, was secret. No one would accept it. And so it's all in the negative. Now, this is especially manifest in the postmodern marketplace that, among other things, believes itself to be the very manifestation of utopia achieved. Another writer, Hefner, says, "The realm of personal slash social need satisfaction has increasingly been tied to the operation of a market, and this has been accompanied by an expansion of socially defined wants and the market geared to their continued growth." He wrote that in 1977. And so he is skeptical of the description of the postmodern critique, which is also drawn to it. He's also drawn to it. Baudrillard will later add some overgeneralized theory to it, but the essential idea is the same. Markets are an impersonal machine. Over time, mass production, advertising, and the total monetization of all social relationships, and that's in quotes, dissolves the so-called market into nothing more than a set of images. But the rise of something like virtual reality just confirms the trajectory. It's just an extreme variation of that. And it's nothing new or special. When you have a postmodern concept that rejects any sense of the objective, you know, the modern world, whether it be the American Constitution or, documents in uprising in 1968 in France, anything like that, and then, of course, 18th century French Revolution, anything like that is based on some objective truth, that human rights are things that are real, or at least utility. None of that is real here. Now, as far as the market is concerned, it is inorganic and artificial, which is, okay, one step away from reality. Now, when you make it abstract, that you monetize it, that's yet another layer of the unreal, making it twice removed from reality. Finally, it's now virtual and global, corresponding to nothing, of course. It dissolves even that realm of illusion, making illusions out of previous illusions. It is now three times removed from reality. Bogard is the most vehement in his rejection of this idea. The establishment in academia never quite knew what to do with postmodernism. They've tried to keep it in the liberal pen, but in many cases, they reject it. There has to be objective reality. But Ryder's trying to rescue Baudrillard, that he's not illiberal. And we're going to, you know, make fun of some of Baudrillard's concepts, even though I respect the man as a writer in many respects. And it's helpful to build a critique of my own, read him. He's not consistent in this stuff. But writers like Bogard, who tried to keep him in that liberal pen, that postmodernism couldn't be used for anything else, deconstruction should never be used against them, he concludes that Baudrillard is wrong because he renders liberal change impossible, and by extension, the academic role in that change. As I said before, liberalism is taken for granted as true. You don't have to argue for it. That something that prevents liberal change is taken for granted. That is a legitimate argument against something because it keeps liberalism from happening. That is a legitimate argument because everyone agrees. And it's getting worse, especially over the last few years. So, you know, they have completely, academia has collapsed in that sense. How that's a reason to reject Baudrillard remains a mystery, but this is how liberalism has responded to postmodernism. It cuts them off from reality, too. Of course, why we should listen to the postmodernists, given that idea, how they avoid being a simulacra of themselves is a mystery. But that's an argument deriving from professional self-interest. I mean, he actually says that one has to reject Baudrillard because academic liberals would be out of a job, or that academic social science would cease to exist. Things like policy, social sciences, and maybe academia itself are always uncomfortable when deconstruction is turned on themselves. When I first read about the concept of deconstruction, the first thing I thought of is that this is a disaster for the regime, because it can be immediately turned on liberalism. You have others like Rubinstein in 1989 use it only for partisan purposes. The postmodern criticism might itself be criticized or even parodied, but it's difficult to reject it entirely for any of us. So Baudrillard states, and he's talking about America in this case, yes, California, and America with it, is the mirror of our decadence, but it is not decadent at all. It is hyper-real in its vitality. It has all the energy of the simulacrum. It is the world's center of the inauthentic. Certainly it is. That is what gives its originality and power. The irresistible rise of the simulacrum is nothing you can simply feel here without the slightest effort. I'm sorry, it's something you can feel here without the slightest effort. Now, that was published in 2010, though he died in 2007. The problem here is that energy need not come from the real. Originality almost requires the make-believe. Power has to justify itself through the creation of an imaginary world, and liberalism is forced to do that. Deconstruction tears that to pieces. That's why it's simply not done, in at least within the university system. So what I just quoted from Baudrillard is not a positive view, and it doesn't defend the present system. It also doesn't reject it. And he uses a word irresistible. The irresistible rise of the simulacrum, he says. So if the system itself is irresistible, it is in part because the system is inevitable and is true as far as that goes. Now, I don't know if it's simply not him not being careful or him showing his underlying rejection of his own theory. So what I've said so far here, the social sciences pretend that what they analyze is somehow objective, and that's torn apart by postmodernism. B, that the market and individual needs and desires are some of those objects that sociologists think is objective. And C, that such mechanisms can be analyzed like any other social phenomenon. And this is something very important. This actually serves our interest, nationalism, paleoconservatism, very, very well. You know, one of the things that irritates me, one of the truckload of things that irritate me, is universities offering non-academic fields as if they're academic fields. And the paradigmatic concept is marketing. Somehow marketing is an academic field by itself. You've had some great writers in academia actually scathing and, you know, parodying marketing. Market-oriented writers and the market as such claim that this is the epiphany of freedom itself. The truth is that the free market has long become a set of images delivering the message that, in being absorbed into this matrix, the subject is now a nonconformist and even a rebel. Of course, the rebel is safe from repercussions because even the act of rebellion is stylized, standardized, and rendered hyper-real. And, you know, a lot of writers like Applebaum and a few others cite some authorities in this so-called field, marketing, to the effect that customers do not know their interests. Well, we know that already. Marketing is based on the idea that their needs are indeterminate, apart from the most staple items. Therefore, they need to be led and directed. Now, the quickest cursory glance at your high-priced advertisement shows this to be true, but the system as such is justified by reference to reason. That's the crux of the matter. The free market, liberal democracy, are based on basic French revolutionary ideas that people are rational and they don't need the state or anybody else to construct their life. And that's simply not true. They're not reasonable or rational. But today, reason is defined in the most vulgar way possible. It's the constant search for one's utility, value, and profit. It's rationalization more than anything else. Advertising, marketing, as a make-believe field, deals entirely with manipulation. That's why it has no right to be in a university or anywhere else. It's not a legitimate field. It's not even a moral field. This is part of what invents the market rather than actually responding to the market. But things like utility and value and profit for the person, they may be defined broadly, but they manipulate the mass of the population in the name of individual self-creation, so it's purely a contradictory notion. The system is allegedly undergirded by reason, but it functions by a sole appeal to the passions. So implying that the market is based on the rational maximization of utility on the one hand, while acting as if the mass are a mere herd on the other. So those who control the market are mocking the herd, rubbing their nose in their inability to realize that they live in a world created by anonymous others. That the mass, the herd, remain unaware is part of the process. The more inert the herd proves itself to be, the more powerful the regime becomes. I was in a debate many years ago over ISIS. And of course, you know my position on that. Western intelligence created it from the ground up, financed it, whatever. And people, I was criticized there by pointing to some of their Photoshops, fake videos, because the Photoshops, despite this being a very wealthy organization somehow, with their own economy and currency, and prison system and everything else, that they're simply incapable of creating good Photoshop. Well, my answer was simple. It's because they did it on purpose. The regime needs to see how far it can push. I remember when the bailouts were announced after 2008. I said to myself, if nothing is done, if there's no mass protests here, then I know it's over. So the mass is unaware of this process. They actually believe that politics, quote unquote, is what they see discussed on CNN or Fox News. And this is why Baudrillard is absolutely correct. Now, Applebaum, who wrote in 1998, he says, Coca-Cola and McDonald's surely must be counted among the seven wonders in modern times. Beholding this massive barrage of communications all shouting by me, although in fact the message is choose me, the critics have often held that a force capable of co-opting consciousness in this way must be organized, conniving, and hegemonic. Well, this is true, of course, and end quote. Well, this is true, of course. Someone like Applebaum, a Jewish liberal in academia, would rather not be associated with it. He substitutes the idea that the simulacra of hyperreality, economically speaking, are appropriated by consumers for, quote, the procurement and use of commodities for the purpose of self-construction, end quote. Only problem here is that the foundation for this identity that consumers are constructing is nowhere to be found. There is no source of it. In other words, you can't agree that the social world is little more than images, while still arguing that there is some fundament from which the sovereign individual can construct himself. So the concept of the self, of the individual, is also melted away by postmodernism. Doesn't happen often, but that's essentially what they've done. That's how they've rendered it. Again, liberals and leftists have a big problem with that. Now, he argues that, quote, the aspect of the cosmology that I address is the implicitly held theory of needs and their purported satisfaction through the mutually constructed cultural economic entity of the free market, end quote. So while claiming that this cosmology, the free spirit, is pure illusion, he insists that the same self-construction is autonomous. I mean, this is classic cognitive dissonance. They can talk about the simulacra, the hyperreal, the fact that people live in a dream world constructed by others, but they still are building their lives according to reason and confidence. This is an attempt to save the social sciences from postmodernism, and it fails, because the basis on which an individual will seek to construct herself may be derivable from some power, something with significance, but this authority, of course, is usually pop culture or one of its derivatives. Again, part of the matrix. And this is what Baudrillard says, again, in the posthumous book. It's unexplained academic innocence here. And he says, politics frees itself in the spectacle, in the all-out advertising effect. Sexuality frees itself in all anomalies and perversions. Mores, customs, the body, and language free themselves in the ever-quickening round of fashion. The liberated man is not the one who is freed in his ideal reality, his inner truth, or his transparency. He is the man who changes spaces, who circulates, who changes sex, clothes, and habits according to fashion rather than morality. Now, I want to note here that he was talking about the rise of transsexualism at least before 2007. Now, of course, that's an obvious and vulgar example of the regime simply inventing an issue, inventing a cause that really connects to nothing because there's so few of these people. And, of course, standing the idea of mental illness on its head and destroying anyone who disagrees. But, of course, given what I just quoted here, given the sheer depth of the immersion into the matrix, it's hard to argue with him. But, you know, think of that quote. It sounds like a paleoconservative. It sounds like he's attacking the results of liberalism. His reputation as a leftist, though, renders these critical ideas fashionable, but unfortunately hyper-real. I think of what, you know, Russell Kirk, one of the first conservative writers I ever read in my life. He writes, I think it would be better if the choice could be made for society to be dissolved into its constituent atoms than for society to become one featureless bulk of production men and consumption men. As a media for expression of thought decay or expire, the parlor tables in British hotels are covered with a new spawn of trade journals and automobile company magazines, luxuriously printed, fat and glossy, published out of the ample advertising funds of the great stock companies. Now, he wrote that in 1956. It is the identical criticism of Baudrillard, coming from two different points of view, two different backgrounds, but the absolute identical criticism. So now you have liberals worried. So Russell Kirk's quote is no different from Baudrillard. Had the name been removed, if I didn't say that was Baudrillard, you would think that it's a Russell Kirk or it's someone like this. So the way academia works is that you can say something like that. But the minute you say, oh, no, this is a postmodern version, they'll go, oh, that's okay. You say if it's Russell Kirk's version, oh, you need to be fired. Making the exact same argument actually depends on the label, not the argument itself. Now, people like Russell Kirk, who I've always respected, his approach, developed at the length of his long career, contains substantial criticism of market relations, mass society, and the force that creates them both. The substitution of base desire for traditional conceptions of virtue. And of course, virtue has to be connected to a functioning ethno-nation and language. Confusingly, the postmodern conservatism is actually a variation of libertarianism, whose love of the postmodern market and its globalized enforcement regime know no bounds. Libertarianism, of course, generally speaking, is a fraud, or at least in its mainstream elements. The scholar, academic scholar Hefner says, "This system, in turn, has had a most dramatic effect on other world cultures increasingly linked to events originating in the West, and this many people would see an event of tragic proportions." Now, of course, when he says something like that, he needs to clarify what he means by the West. He certainly can't be talking about the West of Aristotle or Aquinas. He could only be using the simulacra of the West to refer to the social degeneration Kirk and his followers rightly decry. And Baudrillard, as a postmodernist, he agrees. He says, "Utopia has been achieved here, and anti-utopia is being achieved. The anti-utopia of unreason, of deterritorialization, of the indeterminacy of language and the subject, the neutralization of all values, and the death of culture," end quote. So what values are he, what is he talking about here? The neutralization of all values, what values is he talking about? That's the problem. Baudrillard seems to be in full agreement with Russell Kirk and many others like that, but overtly saying so is very non-academic. He's not going to last in academia very long. Now, from out of nowhere, after this very good critique, here's what we read. "The great lesson of all of this is that freedom and equality, like ease and grace, only exist where they are present from the outset. This is a surprise democracy had in store for us. Equality is at the beginning, not the end. That is the difference between egalitarianism and democracy. Democracy presupposes equality at the outset. Egalitarianism proposes it at the end." Almost contradicting everything he said before. Where are these abstractions coming from? How are freedom and equality, or democracy, or egalitarianism, how are they anything different from simulacra? Has he brought them back to life? Even worse, what is this mysterious force that will make everyone even in the beginning? And wouldn't that force, by its very existence, prove that such equalization at the outset is impossible? That you would need such violence to make everyone the same? So phrases like this, I mean, completely out of sync with the rest of his writings. It's almost like they're not written by the same man. But these kind of, you know, very modernist, very libertarian constructs are more concessions to his academic readership than to serious ideas. Of course they're in conflict. It's the same thing for McIntyre. He can criticize individualism, he can criticize liberalism, but he will not put anything in its place because that will expose him to brutal attacks. So, back to Baudrillard's concept here. A simulatory culture is a world where words don't have reference. There is no corresponding object. Well, that's not culture at all, of course. I refer to the American world, or American social world, as an anti-culture. It has no foundation other than the simulacrum. And this, you know, Baudrillard's absolutely correct. But such falsity requires a population to accept it. They're hypnotics. You know, the population shares a role in their own enslavement. So this is Baudrillard's conception of a virtual or simulatory world, one where the entire planet is brought to accept these images as real. Insanity or terror is defined as not accepting them as real. And this is something he's gotten a lot of trouble for in his academic career years ago. They bring benefits to their subjects in that they are easier than reality, of course, since they are infinitely plastic and malleable. This is the final manifestation of the Enlightenment and its drive to reshape reality. That's the nature of the globalized world, the simulacra. It is easier than reality. And this world has been created by globalized capital. Now, globalization is essentially economic. National cultures were considered inconveniences. So the less cultural specificity exists, the easier it is to bring them into the vortex of capitalist relations without a foundation for resistance. So postmodernism is a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it scathingly criticizes the foundation of global liberalism and globalization, but on the other hand, leaves you no place to stand. The only thing that could replace it is more simulacra. And this is one of the things that had, and Baudrillard was forced to distance himself from this stuff as he got older. So, if we follow his reasoning, the global culture, as if there could be such a thing, is a system. It's a network of images. Its goal is profit, but it's far more than that. The system must be recognized at all levels as the obvious good, the natural ideal of the human race. It can't have its claim to be the universal satisfaction of all human desire cast into doubt. Even if there's a handful of fanatics, their very existence is overwhelming to the system. It is humiliation that it fears most of all. Another way of putting that is that they fear exposure. They fear what legitimate deconstruction can do to their intellectual hegemony over people. So again, even if there's just a handful of us that reject the regime, that actually try to deconstruct where this nonsense comes from, where globalization comes from, whatever, even if it's just a few of us, and there's certainly a lot more than a few, it still is overwhelming to the system. They simply can't handle it. Academia, and I've always claimed that the college campus is an experiment. I mean, not literally, of course. That's the left's plan for America, is the college campus, which is terrifying. But the global order, the postmodern global order, has its own life, language, and social relations, but they correspond only to the images the system projects as reality. And of course, that's in quotes. That's an aspect of the regime in my own definition of that term, with a capital R. Regime not only is this power based on the total collapse between the difference between public and private capital, public and private institutions, but also they take advantage of the intellectual confusion in the West to invent their own language. These images, that's absolutely true, even though, of course, they'll claim it's only intersubjective. They'll talk about relativism when it comes to things like sexuality, but if you bring up the Holocaust, that is an objective truth that can never be questioned. It doesn't stand with the rest of their theory, but they have no choice but to say that. So the images that the regime projects as reality globally are infinitely malleable. They're plastic. They correspond to the interests of those who project them and craft the desires of those who receive them. You know, racism is an easy example. It has no definition. Fascism has no definition. But they need to maintain that moral punch where if you do anything that may be considered vaguely irritating to blacks in America, you should lose your job and bank account. Again, that's not really a sign of a healthy, stable regime. Now, Baudrillard says that the world that they invent is more exciting than the real one. And this is what hyperreality really is. It's a pseudo-ontological foundation for the present globalized order. An example of that are these philosophies that base their existence on the existence of, you know, something like the Holocaust or the evil Germans in World War II. The philosophy has to be false because it's based on something that is highly, highly questionable. And you really start, well, everyone knows that the Holocaust is real, therefore we can't have that happen again, therefore these guys have to be fired. But the hyperreal is a system of relations, simulacrum that, taken together, form a system more or less rational that is more exciting than the mundane world of actual reality. And most people really can't tell the difference anymore. Virilio, another writer in 1995, argued that, quote, there is no such thing as globalization. There is only virtualization. What is being effectively globalized by instantaneity is time. Everything now happens within the perspective of real time. Henceforth, we are deemed to live in a one-time system, end quote. So, relative to culture, he's arguing that the richness and diversity of history comes from the local, that is, the national or the ethnic. Virtualization and universalization means destruction. It is hypnosis. Remember what hypnosis is. It has nothing to do with trances. That's stage magic nonsense. Hypnosis is the focus on something to the extent that nothing else exists. When someone's really into writing, someone's really into singing, the world could be burning behind them and it won't break their concentration. That's hypnosis. So it's not a terrible thing. But the system, you have the mask and you have the regime. They need each other. The hypnosis is driven by the consumer, the so-called subject. This isn't forced on society. But once any sense of the absolute has been destroyed, society loses any purpose or aim. Things like the will to power aren't sufficient. There's no objectivity there. There's no truth there. And it's abstract. This void makes the subject easy prey for the friendlier virtual world, the more exciting virtual world. You know, if you take your politics from Fox News and CNN and read the papers and read the occasional mainstream book on a political topic, you have zero knowledge of what politics really is. You have a simulacrum. You have a set of images promoted by those with power. It's fraud. Postmodernism and even the way that postmodern globalization has functioned, there really is no purpose of society anymore. So substituting the virtual world is a diabolical and a diabolically brilliant plan on the part of the regime. Reality, true reality, forces people to make hard choices and be responsible for their acts. Now, the world of consumer images makes no such demands. And since it's based on some vague relativism, the struggles for virtue and the good aren't really significant. Another writer in this school, Fisher, he says, quote, being realistic may once have meant coming to terms with or of a reality experience as a solid and immovable thing. Capitalist realism, however, entails subordinating oneself to a reality that is infinitely plastic, capable of reconfiguring itself at any moment. End quote. It's a virtual world created by the drive for profit. And only this society could have done it because the technology is at a point now where that's not that difficult to do. You need the technology to make this happen. You need a mass, a herd, not an actual society. You need the occasional depression or recession to get people scared. You know, everything from viruses to war, whatever it is. And you have the drive for profit itself. The global order that they have to create. And globalism is nothing more than shutting down, lowering transaction costs because nations and currencies have different ways of doing business, and they want to destroy that. And I think to some extent that's already been done. So you have the regime, the herd, and the media in between them. But the media has to be a monopoly. You can't have substantial rejection of the simulacrum, or you're going to have chaos in their mind. So only when you have a total monopoly of media control and mass censorship, now the mass are easy prey. But always, it's a risk. I learned this from Michael Hoffman, one of my favorite ideas there. These guys are incredibly wealthy and powerful. They didn't get that way by not taking risks. They know that if the herd figures out what's happening and can't take it anymore, which in many cases, you know, there are some reasons to think that it, in a limited way it's true, then it's over for them. So as the Bible says, they know their time is short. Money is a simulacrum in and of itself. And as Marx said, the same thing, reduces all human relations to it. So once our interaction is reduced to dollars, the human, however you define that, is totally effaced. And that's straight from Baudrillard in that case. And he calls this violence. He redefines the word violence to refer to this. So violence is defined by Baudrillard as the process of reducing all reality into monetary relations, destroying social life. The violence of the system is manifest, quote, in our own submission to an integral technology, a crushing virtual reality, to the grip of networks and programs, which perhaps represents the involutive profile of the entire species, of the human race become global, end quote. Now, the broader point, of course, is that it is a generator of images that decides what reality is and hence who is outside of that reality. Now, he defines violence a bit differently from terror. Terror is, again in quotes, is anything that exists outside of the system. It is everyone who seeks its subversion through unmasking its values, deconstruction. Terrorism is defined by Baudrillard and by the regime as anything that threatens to rip the veil away from what globalization is. Terrorists are they're people who seek the reestablishment of specific cultures. They're by definition illiberal and hence dangerous to the system. He wrote that back in 1988. The regime sees terror as both a problem and opportunity. The regime, its intensely powerful bureaucratic organization, does not permit it to effectively respond right away. That machine, neither public nor private, that the regime maintains, can't fight a guerrilla war because this war follows no rules. So-called guerrilla terrorists don't wear uniforms. They don't follow any standard military protocols. And, of course, they always have a flair for the symbolic. The symbolic refers to those ideas that are expanded beyond their initial impact and they become emblematic of their broader ideas. So, for example, 9/11, taken completely out of its context and made the foundation for military policy or thought afterwards. 9/11 destroyed the Trade Towers and surrounding buildings, mysteriously. But in the virtual world, it's far more than that. It served to humiliate the insulated projectors of the hyperreal. These eternally invisible terrorists, quote unquote, of course, are a threat because they actually live in the real. They have a solid culture and are not enmeshed in hyperreality. They're dangerous. And whether they commit a violent act or not, they're terrorists. But as I said, violence is an opportunity for the regime because they'll simply use it to break us down and to shut us down. Anyone talking about violence from our side is working for them. There's no question. But guerrilla bands have defeated, so-called terrorists, guerrilla bands I've been talking about for some time, that those living in the hyper-real, that the U.S. is an invincible military machine, but they apparently can't handle them. The existence of any of these guerrilla bands, in Afghanistan, they're large enough to cause fear, but not so large as to take the system head-on. And they're used to keep everyone on guard. Now, that completely collapsed in Afghanistan. People then become fearful and suspicious, which leads to a state of great suggestibility. And you have people like Naomi Klein, who stole and plagiarized her entire career, of course, and argues that a crisis is used to buttress the system of images. Baudrillard argues that when the system runs out of enemies, it has to create them. Well, that's no news for us, but apparently in academia, it is. The upsurge against it is sporadic and decentralized, like guerrilla warfare is, but it still remains only an irritant. They are the revenge of the singular, what he calls the singular, against the global order, the constant drive to homogenization. One race, one world, one currency, one set of laws. But globalization has been created by economic actors, and those economic actors are far more powerful than any state, to the point now where there is no state. Writers like John Urey in 2005 say, quote, empire is a sovereign power, creating a smooth world, the single logic of rule that now governs the world. This new sovereignty is deterritorialized and decentered with a merging and blending of a global rainbow, end quote. Schultz 2002, he says the same. But he argues that the imperial use of technology can empower as well as disempower those seeking to resist it. You have those like Poster in 2008, who argues that the four universal ideas stressed by Baudrillard are the final manifestation of the Enlightenment. They're not universal at all, of course. They never were. The universal claims of globalization are Western European. They're elite, purely modern, based on concentrated capital and mechanization. Now, I just engaged in a very brief deconstruction. The regime will say that globalization is inevitable, irresistible. It's based on human rights, the free market, the protection of democratic institutions. And we could tear that to pieces. There's nothing universal about any of it. It derives from alienated Western European elites. It is oligarchic. It could exist only in the modern world. And it's based on concentrated capital seeking to lower labor costs by moving outside the country. That's what I mean by deconstruction. It's not this universal harbinger of a new age based on human rights. But to reject the world of images is, even passively, to be an outsider. The problem is that none of the authors in this field are outsiders. They're deeply enmeshed in the system and have made their peace with it, even Baudrillard. One of Baudrillard's dumbest arguments is that the media invented the Iraq War because there really was no war. It was a one-sided, you know, destruction of Iraq. Well, he gets that entirely from the media. No, the Iraqi forces fought extremely hard and stymied the Americans for years. So I don't know why he trusts the media in this sense. Even with the Bosnian crisis, he blames the Serbs. How evil they are. We have to expose this. Well, whatever happened to the simulacra? Whatever happened to the hyperreal? That's a media invention and nothing else. What is he talking about? The guys like that do this all the time. And it's not uncommon. The same thing for 9/11. He wrote The Spirit of Terrorism. He called it the absolute event. And he does say, though, that it is a reaction to the technological and political expansion of what we've been talking about here, pure internationalism, rather than a war of a religious society. But calling it an absolute event allowed him to be attacked for romanticizing the so-called terrorists, despite being correct in that sense. As I know, I'm running out of time. I'm not going to get to everything I have here. What else is new? But you have someone, even people like Bauman, of course, rejects the religious movements against globalization and reduces them to a longing for certainty in an uncertain world, an escape from extremely complicated problems which we cannot even name, nostalgia for a lost, simple world and the elementary array of tasks within this world. That was in 2006, which is a dismissal of the rebellions against globalization. He doesn't realize that religious and ethnic foundations for rebellion is one of the reasons that they won, and they continue to win in places like Afghanistan and elsewhere. But that dismissal is an example of oversimplification itself, the use of virtual symbols to reject illiberal movements against the same liberalism he too rejects. These are all postmodernists in one form or another. But they're scared to death that postmodernism can be used to deconstruct liberalism, and hence the academic world. And that's why they're quick to jump on anybody who may go in that direction. And of course, you know, people like Bauman, they have no solutions to these problems. Any rebellion against globalization is just as bad as globalization. The funny thing is, Bauman, like so many of these other guys, critique modern liberalism extremely well. The people who he's now condemning use the exact same language he does. David Harvey, in 2005, A Brief History of Neoliberalism, he writes that capitalism appropriated the rhetoric of the liberty of consumer choice not only with respect to particular products, but also with respect to lifestyles, modes of expression, and a wide range of cultural practices, end quote. So, from the point of view of academic liberalism, he's treading on dangerous ground. He even says, quote, New York's elites acceded to the demand for lifestyle diversification, including those attached to sexual preference or gender, and increasing consumer niche choices, end quote. In other words, capitalism, neoliberalism, and the hyperreal are all connected. New York's elites, who is he referring to there? Yeah, this is a mainstream academic writer. The machinery of hypnosis that makes it all hang together, he summarizes this way. The narcissistic exploration of self, sexuality, and identity became the leitmotif of bourgeois urban culture. Artistic freedom and artistic license promoted by the city's powerful cultural institutions led, in effect, to the neoliberalization of culture. So I may leave this as a part one because I thought I'd be able to get through the whole thing, but some of these concepts are difficult, and so there'll be a part two next week. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.